from HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 89, recorded live Thursday, November 15th, 2007. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RED Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks with longtime Microsoft developer Larry Osterman.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm sitting here in building
85
with Larry Osterman, longtime Microsoft employee. How long have you been here?
Bit over 23 years.
Wow. Okay. Have you been in this office that long?
I've been in this office for about a month and a half, 2 months.
Oh, okay.
Maybe.
I noticed that your name tag out front says Lawrence. I'm not sure who put that up. Probably not you.
Some facilities person pulled it out because that's the name that's used on official documents. And when I was hired in here, of course, you use your official name, the name that's on your Social Security card. And
yeah, yeah.
But there ain't nobody I know who calls me that.
I was going to say, I was like, is this the same guy? I wasn't sure.
No.
Is your badge number really low?
Badge numbers don't matter.
There's
no relationship between badge number and employee.
Oh, because I got a low one, and I was like, I feel special. I have a low badge number.
Nah, I mean, my badge number's got 5 digits, and it's in the mid-5 digits.
Okay, so it's not like badge, you know, 8 or something.
No. I mean, as of today, I'm number 31 in seniority in the company.
Hmm.
So
I'm not sure what that gets you. Maybe a better –
It doesn't get me anything.
You can get in line at the picnic earlier.
It doesn't get me anything. I mean – I don't even get in line at the picnic. All I get is, I get a little glass plaque that says, "Hi, you've been here for a really, really long time. There are people in your group who were not born when you started working at Microsoft."
Let me tell you, that is
scary.
Yeah, it's funny. I've only been here 8 weeks. I've been in the industry about 15 years, but I've only been at Microsoft 8 weeks. I went through Neo, and it gave a couple of interesting statistics. First one was that 16% of the company was hired in the last year.
That's terrifying.
Oh, yeah. It was unspeakable. And then when they said, how many people here are being hired out of college? Like, you know, most of the room's hands went up. And I was just like – and I was feeling old.
I was hired straight out of college. I've never worked in another company.
Really? You've had one W-2 your whole life?
I have had one W-2 my entire life.
That has got to make the paperwork so much easier.
Yeah, I mean, it's just
– That's great. Now, when you have that kind of perspective, I mean, you've got 23 years here, 23 years in the business. Why aren't you burned out? I mean, I'm burned out. I just kind of go, I'm going to become a nurse. I'm going to stop programming. I'm done. This is ridiculous. Computers are stupid. Don't you do that?
No. The wonderful thing about working at Microsoft especially is that there's always something cool happening. There's always something really cool. And there is no other place in the world that you can work on something and have what you work on touch the lives of literally a billion people. I mean, there's 800 million people, 500 million people out there who are using software that I wrote. The stuff I worked on for Windows Vista, there's probably close to 100 million people using that. Now think about that. That's like insane that there's that many people using. And frankly, there's a ton of really cool things that Microsoft does. It really is. I mean, yeah, we're Microsoft. It's boring. But it's not. If you've got the right attitude, and it's just fun. Oh, I mean, in 23 years, I've done network file systems. I've done discovery agents. I've worked on email servers. I've worked on embedded chips for home automation. I've done audio. I mean, video delivery systems. I've done all sorts of things. And the really cool thing about working for Microsoft is that when you get tired of your job, You don't have to go looking for a job somewhere else. You can just find something really cool and neat that's just in the next building over. And that's just, I just love that.
You know, that's interesting that you say that because, I mean, I'm only like 2 months in the job and I'm like, hey, I don't know if I want to do this for the rest of my life. And I said that to someone at Microsoft and it's like, oh, it's okay. You'll have a totally different job in 18 months.
Maybe. Some people do.
I don't know. I mean, the idea that you can bounce around. I mean, how do you do that? I mean, how long have you been in the job that you've been in now?
I've been about 5 years in my current job. I was about 6 years in the job, did 6 years in exchange, 4 years in Windows NT.
You just decided it was time? We just like, oh, you know, I think I'm ready to do something else.
It was time. It was time to, you know, in exchange, we shipped Exchange 2000 and I was burned out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was burned out. And there's no question I was burned out. I was tired of doing it. And I said, okay, fine. I'm done. I'm out of here. And went and looked for a job and found something that was nice and low stress for a couple of years. And
mm-hmm.
that was that embedded chip thing, which is a very small project. It was like five people working on it. And, you know, when that one finally shipped, I went looking for another job. And in that case, another job found me, which was this job on the sound team.
Yeah, so that's a good question. So what are you working on now? You're on the sound team. What kind of things are you working on?
Well, our team owns the audio infrastructure for Windows.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm working on stuff for the next version of Windows. And, mm-hmm. and unfortunately, I can't say what that stuff is.
Sure.
But
we can talk about Vista. I mean, the sound system, if I understand correctly, changed dramatically in Vista, did it not?
We threw away everything above the driver level and replaced it. And we also dropped in a new driver model.
Mm-hmm.
as well for new drivers, but existing drivers continue to work. We changed, as I said, everything else. It all used to be running as drivers in the kernel, and we mm-hmm. moved it all up into user mode. And we then rewrote all of the APIs that worked with the old system mm-hmm. to work with the new system.
Like one of the things that was from a user's perspective that I found the most surprising about Vista was when I clicked on the volume and I had separate volume for each application.
That was mine.
That was
me.
Was that seriously you?
That was seriously me. That was the thing I was working on and had been working on for the past 4 years, more or less. And there's a lot of other things, but my big thing I'd been working on was per app volume, and volume control in general was one of the things that I spent, oh my God, Microsoft has some guy who spent 4 years working on just the volume control? Oh yeah, actually he did. Microsoft did. It turns out actually it's a surprisingly hard problem, especially per application volume control, because what's an application? You can say we want per application volume control. And that's a really easy thing to say and to put on a slide.
Uh-huh. And someone did that. I assume someone had that idea and felt it was important enough for you to spend so much time on it.
Exactly. Somebody did. Somebody sat down and said, we have customers who are complaining about this problem. We need to fix it, so we're going to fix it. And we went off and said, okay. Well, it turns out that at the Win32 level, at mm-hmm. the OS level, an application is a process.
Right.
But from a customer standpoint, that's not necessarily what they see.
Probably a taskbar button from the customer.
A taskbar button is what users think. But a taskbar button, it turns out, isn't really very – there's no way of knowing. I could have 50 taskbar buttons that are associated with one process. I can't differentiate it. Half of those taskbar buttons might not be doing anything with audio at all. How do I tell? How do I correlate? How do I relate those? And it turns out it's a very hard problem. Hosting environment – hosting environments also cause problems. Internet Explorer and Firefox are the big ones.
Mm-hmm.
These are applications that tabbed, for instance, if you've got multiple tabs,
mm-hmm.
you can have different multimedia content playing on each of those tabs. You may not even know that it is because there's some ad that's playing an annoying sound in the background.
I hate that.
I hate it too.
Yeah, opening
nothing
middle
worse.
Click, open a new tab, and then something starts playing. Hey, how's it going? And you can't alt-tab to it because it's behind another tab.
Mm-hmm. I cannot tell you how much I despise websites that announce themselves with audio. Yeah. I just find that extraordinarily annoying. But those are hosted. Those are all living within one process. But again, to the user, they're different. It's not another application because they know it's all within Internet Explorer, but
mm-hmm.
they want to treat them differently. So it's a very, very, very hard problem. We had to make some compromises to get things working in a way that would make users happy.
So how much of that logic, when you say it's a very hard problem, in my mind, I'm kind of like drawing truth tables and trying to figure out how I would solve something like that. And certainly I can't solve your 5-year problem in 20 seconds of thinking about it. But my first impression is this something that is, fuzzy logic? Is there heuristics about this? Or is it fairly, just a fairly complicated flow chart where it's like, here are all the edge cases that we're going to handle. Here are some applications that we know that are, poorly behaved as far as, there are multiple processes, but the user thinks of them as one application, or there are multiple taskbar buttons. I mean, what kinds of hints is the app giving you?
Well, the big one is the process. And that's what we finally decided to do was to go with the process is your natural boundary. And it turns out it's actually not that complicated. Or we had a solution that wasn't actually that complicated when we finally got down to it. And the challenge, of course, is coming up with a solution that is not that complicated. You can come up with really, really complicated ones, but the simple ones are almost always better. In this case, what we did was we defined this concept of an audio session. And an audio session is simply a collection of audio streams. So when you're playing audio, you generate a stream of bits of 16-bit or 32-bit or whatever it is numbers. And we aggregate each of those streams into what we call a session. By default, a process has a session. And it's just got it has an ID of zero. When you construct an audio stream, you can optionally say, I want this audio stream to be in a session with the name of Fred. You, the application developer, get to choose a session. And then from that, actually, it turns out almost everything else falls out. The only thing we had to add to that, on top of that initial idea, was the concept of a cross-process session. And that's actually used for the Windows Sounds. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've noticed, but there's one slider that's always pinned there for Windows Sounds.
Right. Because my question was, someone might go and say an Explorer opened each thing in a different process window. Mm-hmm. You might have multiple instances of Explorer EXE.
System Sounds, and actually we enhanced the PlaySound API so that third-party applications can use this. System Sounds, for PlaySound, it's the sound_system flag. But System Sounds basically have their own session. And there's basically just, it's a flag and they run cross process. In that case, the audio engine or the volume control logic in the audio engine doesn't care what process is being used to play the audio.
Mm-hmm.
Again, a session is a collection of streams. Well, those streams can come from one process, mm-hmm. from multiple processes. The engine doesn't care.
Okay. So let's say I've got Windows Media Player and that's running some audio and something goes wrong, the file's corrupt, and then a message box pops up and it goes wonk. That's coming from the System Sounds?
Yeah. And that would have the System Sound volume associated with it. And that's because the message box API calls into, through a surprisingly complicated path, unfortunately, calls into a piece of code that's running in the system that eventually calls PlaySound, and it specifies the System Sound flag. So we try to differentiate notification sounds that the system generates and audio that the application generates. And as I said, for applications that have environmental effects like click navigation sounds or new mail notifications,
mm-hmm.
you can set flags basically that you can opt into the, I really want to treat this as if it was a system sound and not like my sound, because it's really an environmental part of the experience. It's something that I'm just making clicks and beeps or whatever it is in the background.
So if the user is not, if the user, meaning the application developer, is not setting these flags, if they haven't chosen to take advantage of these,
it shows up under the process.
It just goes by process. And so that's what makes it simple. Because in my mind, I was thinking that you're taking all sorts of cues about what shows up in the volume control because the window is visible and there is a process. So,
I can't find out any of that information.
You're too deep, aren't you?
I'm too deep. In the audio service, I'm completely isolated from the user's desktop. I have no knowledge and cannot have any knowledge about Windows or anything like that. That's actually mostly because of a security feature that was put in for Windows Vista called Session Zero Isolation. It turns out there's a lot of applications that in Windows XP said, I'm a service, but I can enumerate everything on the user's desktop. Mm. And they can, I can figure out what Windows
is that the service can interact with desktop.
Well, it's not even that because in, even if you didn't have the service can interact, mm-hmm. you could still enumerate if you were in session zero. Ah. So if you were the very first user logged onto the machine, it worked fine. And there's a lot of applications and services that figured they could do that. And it turns out they never actually really worked. Their test matrix wasn't good enough. They never tested the fast user switching scenario.
Yeah.
Because they would have discovered even under XP that under fast user switching, it just didn't work.
Yeah.
Well, in Vista, it turned out there's this class of security holes called shatter attacks that occur when you have a privileged service that can interact with the desktop. Or more importantly, mm-hmm. a privileged service that can bring up user interface on the desktop. Mm-hmm. So one of the security fixes that went into Windows Vista is this concept that we call session zero isolation. And basically all services are isolated away from the desktop mm-hmm. and they have no ability to interact with the desktop. That way, when the user's sitting there, it completely neutered that entire class of vulnerabilities. You simply can't have a shatter attack in Windows Vista because it's just gone. The vector that was used to make that attack is gone.
So if someone had one of these evil things in their system and upgraded to Vista, that thing is ultimately just neutered. It may be on the system, but it can't do anything.
Yeah. And it's not an evil thing, actually. It's very clear. It's not an evil thing that did this. It's just something that a programmer took a shortcut that he really shouldn't have
taken.
They're
hapless, but they're not evil.
They're hapless. They're not evil. But the problem is that their code sometimes has bugs in it. Mm. And that's where the problem came from. And that the original shatter attack was because there was a bug mm-hmm. in some code. And it was an OS bug, if I remember correctly, but mm-hmm. there was a bug in some code. And you could use this vulnerability, this class of attacks to exploit and to own a person's machine. These apps have bugs in them sometimes. I mean, it's unfortunately the nature. And they would pop up their UI, and all of a sudden, the bad guy could take advantage of that. One of the particular cases I remember, there was an antivirus application. So you put a virus on your machine. The antivirus scanner says, "You have a virus on your machine." And the virus says, "Oh, look, the antivirus program just popped up." And then they exploited a vulnerability in the antivirus program. And I have no idea which one it is.
But they basically, they've opened up the portal and the thing jumps through.
And they jump through. And then the virus just jumped through and
it's pretty clever.
Infected. At my heart, I'm a security nutcase. I'm a security geek. Uh-huh. That's my passion is security and the mechanisms around security and stuff like that. And I have a huge, huge, huge amount of respect for the ingenuity of the people who do security research and who find vulnerabilities and the techniques that they use. Because while many of the people who use the technology and the techniques that mm-hmm. these guys who are doing the researchers have less than superior skills, many of the people who are actually designing stuff are the pejorative phrase is script kiddies. They're just taking work somebody else did and building on it. But the people who actually do the real research, I have a lot of respect for these guys because what they're doing is really hard. It takes a specialized skill set. And a lot of times some of the stuff that they're finding and that they turn into viable weaponized payloads or payloads that can actually be used reliably, mm-hmm. it takes a lot of work and a lot of time and practice and patience to find some of these things. And that's just cool.
This dance between the iPhone and the people who want to release the iPhone is unreal. It's like I look at Engadget yesterday. Oh, new iPhone update. Everything's back the way it was. We're all shut out. 20 minutes later, we're back.
Mm-hmm. It's exactly right.
If you open a TIFF file inside of the browser, then we're back. And then they get it down to the point where it's a web page. They get it down to the point where you could actually just visit a web page.
And you can
I always have this image in my mind, and I know that we've got a big international audience, so forgive me, but I always imagine this 17-year-old Danish kid, you know, who's off somewhere solving this problem. And they have just the patience of Job to keep poking bits out into space and then do a jump and see if that is a place too.
That's exactly what they do. And some of these guys are really, really sophisticated. There was a talk I attended last year. And the presenter of the talk commented, this was about, hardware encryption. So it explicitly was about hacking game consoles. Mm-hmm. And one of the guys who was commenting is, you know, one of the things people don't understand is some of us have like scanning electron microscopes in our living room. And he puts up a slide that has a picture of his living room. And darn if there isn't a scanning electron microscope next to his couch. And he uses that. He sands off the epoxy on the top of the chips of the things he's trying to hack. And he uses this electron microscope to read the internal circuitry to find out what it does.
How do they, the thing that blows me away is that how do you learn that? And as, and I know I keep saying that I'm an old timer, and I just am saying that when you have 5 years, 10 years, you get these different milestones in your career. You kind of go, wow, it's taken the sum total of all these years for me to get to this point. And then you meet someone who's 22 who has surpassed you.
I know.
How do you, if they don't teach it in school, how do you pick up, you know, 25 years of security experience in four years and then with a scanning electron microscope break into a console? I just, the acceleration of the speed at which they can absorb that is unbelievable.
I don't know. A lot of it, frankly, is because kids start earlier. Mm. The technology, I mean, when I was starting back in the dark ages, I mean, you were lucky if you had an Apple II in your house, you know, an Apple II or a TRS-A, a Radio Shack TRS-80.
Trash 80 was my first
Trash
machine.
80. You were lucky. I mean, it was a big deal. There was a guy down the hall from me in the dorms at college who had a TRS-80, and we would wander by because he was cool. He had a computer in his office. Yeah. When I started, we were in the big iron age, you know, and mm-hmm. what that meant was that, you know, when I got to high school, I got a chance to do time sharing on a real computer, but mm-hmm. no, had no other experience, and it was somebody else's computer. We'd broken into that one very quickly. It was a computer that was secure in name only. We didn't take us very long to find holes in it, but it was, and not that I'm a hacker at all. It's sure. just, and I have actually no skills in that area. It's just, mm-hmm. this was so easy. It was, but back in the late 70s, early 80s, we didn't care. Nobody cared. Nowadays, of course, it's scary. And, I was reading, Cliff Stoll's Cuckoo's Egg, which for some reason I'd never read. I was reading that a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. And he's writing about how the hackers are taking and copying our password files. And it doesn't make any sense that they'd be taking our password files, because you can't do anything with a password file because the passwords are encrypted in the file. And it doesn't do you any good to have the file to do it, because you can't do anything. And I'm reading this and I'm going to my head. It's like, no, no, no. They're mounting an offline dictionary attack against your password file because you can do this. No, no, no. Can't you see that? And of course, he couldn't, because back in 1986, when this happened, nobody had thought about offline dictionary attacks, or at least it wasn't something that people were really thinking about.
Well, and not even offline dictionary attacks, but this rainbow hash thing. Basically, what people are doing is they're taking kind of this, you know, the sum total of all words that could ever exist plus numbers plus, and they'll make 16, 17 gig files using old LAN manager hashes from years ago, and they'll just scan through it and they'll go backwards from the hash to the password.
Absolutely.
That's why LAN manager's turned off by default in Vista.
And that's why LAN manager's turned off by default in Vista, because, and I'm so happy that it's finally turned off in Vista because we made some real serious mistakes back in the 1980s. And these are mistakes that were made in the 80s when it wasn't so insanely critical to get it right. And I don't think anybody really fully understood at that time just how hard it is to get security right. And more importantly, how easy it is to make mistakes.
Insecure by default is,
well, it's not just that. It turns out with a set of relatively reasonable things, you can actually make a fairly robust system. And you validate your inputs always, stay away from the unsafe API calls. There's a couple of really mechanical things that you can do that are actually do a pretty good job of that. But it's when you start saying, I'm going to design an authentication system. Well, I'm going to design an authentication system. That's actually hard. And it turns out if you don't actually talk to people who have done this in the past and who design these for a living, you're going to get it wrong. Mm-hmm. And we see this time and time and time again because people try. They build their own encryption algorithms.
Yeah, yeah.
And they try them and they don't work. And I can't break my own encryption algorithm. You see this, people post this regularly. I come up with a new unbreakable encryption algorithm.
making shareware keys. I made a little application in the 90s for the Palm Pilot to manage blood sugar. And I, rather than paying the $50 to buy a license manager for my shareware keys, I invented an algorithm. And I mean, this was a niche within a niche within a niche. Okay. So mm-hmm. we're talking about type 1 diabetics with Palm Pilots who are geeks. So, I mean, there were like six people cared about this application. And there was an exploit and a crack within a week.
Yeah. Because I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
It's very, 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 very hard to get that right. And which is why, you know, one of the things that Michael Howard and David LeBlanc and their writings to your code book, they're basically commenting, whenever you get the urge to design your own crypto system, resist it. Just don't do it. It's just not worth the effort because you're going to get it wrong unless you're like one of the 20 or 30 people in the world who are capable of designing encryption systems. And the same is true of authentication systems. Well, we rolled our own on some stuff back in the 80s, and we're only now able to cut the cord on this. And I'm just really, 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 really happy that those systems that we deployed back in the 80s have now finally upgraded. Most people have gotten rid of their Windows 95, at least certainly our corporate customers, and have gotten, who are the ones who care about these passwords and stuff like that. Most of them have gotten rid of their Windows 95 machines. They're now finally moving to operating systems, clients that can actually be secured and that have the ability to be secure.
So for those listeners who don't have the context, we talked about LAN Manager briefly, and mm-hmm. there's a number of DLLs and their LM, this and that. I mean, mm-hmm. and you'll find those keys in Windows, but people may not necessarily have an understanding of that history. I mean, what is that and how did it – why is it still with us?
When I started at Microsoft, we were just shipping DOS 3.1, which was for the PCAT, and the IBM had come up with a product called the PC LAN program, which was basically our very first networking client. We shipped a server, and IBM shipped a server for this, and this was the MSNet product. Its replacement was a product called LAN Manager, which shipped sometime in the 1980s. And was moderately successful. It was a competitor to the NetWare product that Novell had produced and that was wildly successful. As I said, there were some deficiencies in the authentication algorithm, some really serious ones in the authentication algorithm that were identified after we shipped. Moving forward, NT3, we produced a product for OS2 called LAN Manager, actually worked on that product. And
I loved OS2. Oh, I ran Warp for years.
I actually never was on OS2. I was on the predecessor product to OS2. That's what I started. I worked on when I started, and I worked on, and I ended up staying on that project while we, end of lifed it. Basically, we satisfied some corporate customer requirements that we had contracts with customers who had to deliver. And, but I moved off that onto the LAN Manager product, which was, it was a product for OS2, mm-hmm. a network for print server. That's actually where the LAN Manager password security was created and was rolled out first. Mm-hmm. We carried that on through to NT and with NT3.1 and 3.5, and all of our networking products had support for this NTLM style authentication, which is this LAN Manager authentication.
So when we say, so people who are out there, maybe people who've just begun, you know, web
We're
programming,
talking 91.
When they say NTLM, they don't really know what they just, it's an acronym, but it means new technology or what is NT?
Windows NT LAN Manager.
Okay.
And we had at some point the networking stuff inside of Windows NT was called LAN Manager for NT or something like that.
But now when we think about Windows authentication, and we may refer to it as NTLM if we're talking to Vista machines or newer machines, we may refer to it colloquially as NTLM, but it's not using anything with these exploits anymore.
Let me keep on going. Sorry. NTLM V1 had some very severe problems.
Okay.
sometime, and I don't exactly remember where, we rolled out a version 2. Clients from before that time frame, which unfortunately includes Windows 95, had all used this older, weaker LAN Manager 1.0 authentication.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been trying over the years to weed those clients out and not support it. And with mixed results. Finally now, all of those old clients are gone. And in Windows Vista, we finally cut the cord and said, okay, we will no longer support this old authentication mechanism. And what that means is that Windows 95 clients, which still use the weaker authentication, will no longer be supported. They can no longer interoperate or connect to NT machines using the poor authentication mechanism. They have to use some other mechanism.
Mm-hmm. So then the term NTLM kind of lives on to just mean mm-hmm. Windows authentication.
Sort of, yes. There are two styles of Windows authentication right now.
Okay.
There is NTLM, which is this NTLM V2 protocol.
Okay.
And then there is Kerberos, which was introduced with Windows 2000. Most of the time when you're talking from a domain-joined Windows computer that's running Windows 2000 or greater
mm-hmm.
to another domain-joined Windows 2000 computer or later, you're using the Kerberos authentication mechanism to authenticate between the two. And Kerberos, it turns out, is a very high quality, peer-reviewed, industrial strength authentication system developed at MIT that we've adopted as our peer-to-peer authentication. And it's actually, as I said, it's very good, very high quality, is resistant to a huge variety of security attacks that the older protocol, the older NTLM protocol is vulnerable to. So it's a really much better solution. We still support NTLM for non-domain joined machines.
Hmm.
So if you're not a member of the domain and you're trying to talk from one computer to another,
mm-hmm.
When you're talking on your home, for instance,
yeah.
then we're going to use the NTLM authentication mechanism because Kerberos requires a domain.
So this might be an odd question and an odd tangent, but at home I run a work group, so I've got a server. I think it's a Windows Home server or whatever. And mm-hmm. in order to be able to access shares, I have to have another user I make local to that machine with the same name yep. and the same password. And I have to keep those passwords kind of in sync manually. And the wife doesn't know that this happens. So when she goes and she says whack whack server, how is that working? I mean, how is that hash lining up correctly? I don't know if I'm using the right terms, but how is she able to just seamlessly get access to that machine by virtue of the fact that I've put the same passwords on the same machine?
Because there are three pieces to your password.
Okay.
There's your domain, your username, and the password. Those are three things that are used to authenticate you.
Okay.
To determine who you are. When you're a member of a work group, when you're not a member of a domain, your domain is the machine upon which you've been logged on.
But not the work group.
Not the work group.
Okay.
When you go to contact another machine in the work group,
mm-hmm.
it tries using the username, domain, and password. And as I understand it, and I may be slightly wrong on this, but on a non-domain joined machine,
mm-hmm.
what the system does is it first tries to authenticate you using the domain, user, and password.
Mm-hmm.
If that fails, it says, oh, I'm going to throw away the domain part. Since I'm not in a domain, I'm just going to try the username and password, and I'm going to look it up in my local database.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when your wife connects or when you connect,
mm-hmm.
you're accessing the machine, and it comes in and says, hi, I'm on, you know, the kitchen computer and accessing the server. And so you get kitchen, Scott, and Scott's password. That doesn't work. So the server then says, oh, okay, well, how about I just try the server and Scott's password? And that works, and that's how it lets you in, and that's where that.
And that's that NTLM V2.
That's done using the NTLM. Yes, that's done using the NTLM V2.
So then that sounds like a probably good reason to be, you know, maybe close enough. I mean, I know we can't go into the technical details, but the general idea, though, would be that it would be a lot more secure, easier to manage, centrally located if I just put a domain in my house.
Which has its own set of issues.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, putting a domain in your house has its own set of things that come along with them. Domains tend to be a little bit higher maintenance for most home users, myself included. It's not worth the effort. The added security I get
mm-hmm.
is not worth the cost of The added security I get from rolling out a Windows 2000 or Vista server, Windows 2003, whatever, Vista server in my house, the added security I get as mm-hmm. far as using Kerberos inside my house
yeah.
is not sufficient, in my opinion, personally, as yeah. to justify that. Other people may have others. Now, there may be other reasons why you want to deploy small business server in your house. You know, you may want to deploy small business server because you want to do email management and you want to run a web server out of your house or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that might make some sense. And that I certainly know a lot of people who have done that.
Yeah.
And but I wouldn't actually deploy 2003 or 2008 or whatever.
Yeah.
Just for the security, because the kind of attacks that I'm talking about that the current clients are vulnerable to mm-hmm. don't typically involve home scenarios. They can theoretically, and there's absolutely are potential issues there. And I don't want to, but I don't see that being an issue for most customers.
You know, years and years ago when Comcast cable first came out and they didn't partition things where you could actually go into the work in the network neighborhood mm-hmm. and see your neighbor. Mm-hmm. I used to connect to their printer and just print out messages. So they would show up and they'd have, "Hi, it's your neighbor. You might want to think about putting a password on your printer."
Yeah. Well, that's because they left the guest account open, and well, yeah, what do you know? Yeah. There certainly are.
Yeah. One last question I wanted to ask you that I thought that was really, really interesting on your blog, and I know that you've got to get going.
No, it's okay.
Is that you had a really great post talking about threat modeling, and you did threat modeling on a specific API. You basically took one thing. I think it was mm-hmm. PlaySound.
Yep.
And you threat modeled the hell out of it. And I assume that you do that with any public API has to be given this kind of a treatment.
My job, as whenever anybody asks, what do you do?
Uh-huh.
My answer is, I'm the guy who makes Windows go ding. It's one of the reasons why I really like this job is
yeah.
because I can finally have I can explain my job in like five words. It's great.
Yeah.
So I use the PlaySound API, which is what makes the ding and that I own.
Mm-hmm.
That's it, among other things, but sure. I own that API is among other things. So I chose that because it's an API that has, there's complexity associated with it, but it's simple enough that I can do a complete threat model for it in a blog post. Cause I try to keep my blog posts to around 500, 800 words. And
really, I didn't realize you put that thought into it.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. This is I do. And I try to keep it in that range. I can write volumes, but frankly, it takes a lot of time. The more yeah. you write, the more time it takes. And I do this in my spare time. So I don't tend to,
sure.
I can't devote huge amounts of time to it. So I want to be able to have something I could do in smaller chunks. Mm-hmm. Frankly, I think people get fatigued when they try to read really, yeah. really long things. Your eyes glaze over and you start going to textbook mode and you just sort of look for the highlights. So I wanted something small mm-hmm. that could work and that actually had some real threats that would have to be mitigated. So that was why I chose that.
Mm-hmm. So what's a PlaySound threat? I mean, if I'm going to attack PlaySound, what would I have tried and what would fail?
Ah, well, PlaySound plays a file. It plays a WAV file.
Okay.
We were talking and you had actually just made a post in your blog post about recovering a corrupted WAV file.
Okay.
Well, guess what? Corrupted WAV files are a really good way to attack PlaySound.
Hmm.
If you wanted to attack PlaySound, PlaySound is an API that opens a file,
mm-hmm.
parses the contents of that file, reads the contents of that file based on some of the information that was parsed from it,
mm-hmm.
and then hands it to some other APIs to play.
That's a lot of input you're taking on.
There's a lot of input. There's a lot of data that has to be parsed, and that if that data isn't parsed correctly, bad things can happen. It also has modes where it will take a location in memory,
mm-hmm.
again, parse it. So there are lots of inputs to this API. There's the file name itself. I'd start handing in really long file names. See whether you can trip a buffer overflow based on the file name. That's harder to necessarily make exploitable, but maybe you could do something with the file name.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could do something with the file contents. If you have the ability to write to the registry,
mm-hmm.
PlaySound API can read from the user's registry. So if you've got some software running on the user's account, maybe you can find a way to cause some problems with PlaySound by manipulating the registry. Now, that's less useful in terms of as a way of attacking the system because the PlaySound API itself, it turns out, It runs in the context of the user. There's no networking interaction.
Is this part of the moving of things out from the
network? Actually, PlaySound's always been up.
It's always been up there.
Okay. So PlaySound's always been up there in user mode. It's always been living in the context. So there's really not a lot in terms of like cracking the system wide open that you can do with the PlaySound API. But maybe you're a bad guy and you can figure out a way to get a file into the user's hard disk. And then maybe you can find a program that will play that file. So let's imagine a hypothetical web browser. And I don't actually know, I don't believe that there are any web browsers that do this, but let's imagine a hypothetical web browser and somebody says, oh, I want to implement the bgsound HTML tag, which basically takes a WAV file. So it takes a path to a WAV file and plays that. That's how that stupid, annoying background sound we talked about gets played. Or one of the ways it gets played. I'm going to put exploit code into, I find I can exploit PlaySound and I've got a browser that's going to call PlaySound. I'm going to put exploit code into my WAV file that will crack PlaySound. Now, what's the browser going to do? The browser's going to look at the file URL. It's going to take that URL off of my server. It's going to copy that file to the user's local hard drive. And then the browser's going to call PlaySound with the contents of that file. Well, I have two possible ways I can trick the browser. First off, I could pass a really, really long file name. Maybe the browser puts it into the local cache, but keeps the name, the last portion of the file name. So maybe I can convince this non-existent browser to use that. Or maybe if I can find a file format vulnerability, I can trick that browser to cause PlaySound to read that file. And if I can cause browser to read that file, now all of a sudden I might be able to get code running in the context of the currently logged on user. So I've now elevated my privileges from anonymous, which is the internet, to running as the user. Now, you could say, well, it's the fault of the browser. The browser should be checking that. Well, how does the browser know that there's this vulnerable code living underneath it? It's just calling a system API. It's not doing anything that it sees as being anything particularly wrong. And I agree. And the fix should not be in the browser. The bug is that the low-level API, if you have somebody who's calling it unexpectedly on behalf of input from an anonymous source, you could have a problem. And that's why it's important to do everything. And in fact, part of the SDL, security development lifecycle process, includes threat modeling every single feature in the system. And that, not necessarily every API is threat modeled, but certainly every feature, every component in the system. And for Windows Vista, we went through and we did threat models for a ton of the pieces of the operating system. We actually did a lot of work.
And I assume that while you were doing it, you learned stuff. I mean, you didn't do it to validate that, hey, we're awesome. Look, it's secure. But you probably discovered all sorts of interesting things.
We discovered all sorts of interesting threats and all sorts of interesting things. Actually, there is currently a disputed threat or associated with speech recognition. This made a big splash back in January, I believe. Somebody, I think it may have been George Wu, a ZDNet blogger, noticed that if he turned on speech recognition and played back a WAV file that he had recorded with the Windows recorder, that he could cause the WAV file to convince speech recognition to take actions on his behalf.
Okay. I mean, that's really clever. I think we've all had that idea at some point.
But it's a threat. There is a threat there.
I suppose if I held a cell phone up to it, I could probably have people on the cell phone tell my computer what to do.
The Common Vulnerabilities Database, the CVE people, that this is a clearinghouse for vulnerabilities. The CVE people they believe that this is a vulnerability in Windows Vista. Microsoft disputes this. Microsoft believes that this is the Microsoft MSRC people have looked at it and they've said, I don't know about how important this is.
Does that mean I can run down the halls of Microsoft here and start yelling format C colon as I run by someone's office?
You could, in fact. And if, in fact, they were running speech recognition, it's possible that if your speech recognition was trained to be able to recognize your voice, you could, in fact, cause problems. And so that's why I said it's disputed. Yeah. There are different people who believe differently. We actually found this as part of our threat modeling process. This was one of the threats that we covered, that we said, oh, somebody could use speech recognition. And in the case of the audio team, we said, oh, well, you're right. We could, but that's out of scope for the audio team. And then we sent a mail to the speech guys saying, hey, by the way, this is a theoretical issue. Mm-hmm. They made a decision like MSRC did that, we've got a lot of work to do. And the reality is that the severity of this particular vulnerability, and that is something you have to understand,
yeah,
is that security is a continuum. For every – you can't fix every – they are going to hate me for saying this. The security guys are going to hate me for saying this, but – it's a continuum. Okay. There is no such thing as perfect security. You can be completely insecure. That there is
total insecurity.
But there is no such thing as perfect security. It is a continuum. And at some point, when it comes time to, when you're in the business of shipping products, at some point you need to say, okay, we have to ship. We have to make a decision that a line where below this line, we're not going to fix it. And above this line, we are. Mm-hmm. You classify your threats according to the amount of damage that can be caused, the likelihood that they can happen, and you make decisions about what bugs you fix, what bugs you don't fix. You know, every bug that we know that could give an attacker the ability to completely take over the machine, we're probably going to fix those. Things that could cause an attacker to do something bad,
some Microsoft guy told me that the bug level was set at the kill a kitten level. So that if the bug potentially kill a kitten, then they would fix that. Otherwise,
I think the bug's slightly lower than that.
I suspect it's probably considerably lower than that.
It's a lot lower than kill a kitten because nobody wants to kill kittens. But you do have to make choices, and you are always making choices. Every time a bug is submitted, whether it's internal or external, every time a bug is submitted, a team looks at the bug and they say, okay, yes, we're fixing it. No, we're not fixing it. This is the nature of software development. Every bug gets looked at. Every bug gets a judgment call made on it. Now, the majority of the bugs that get submitted get fixed. Really, it's true. You may not believe it, but it's true. Most of the bugs do get fixed. So we're going to take care of most of them, but sometimes bugs come in where it's not as clear and it's not as obvious, especially when you get really close to shipping. Because the closer you get to shipping, there's actually risks associated with every change. Every chain time you change the source code has the possibility of introducing new bugs. So as you get closer to shipping, the bar for submitting new bugs gets really, really high.
So fixing the bug could introduce an even worse bug.
Because fixing the bug can, and we have seen this happen. We've had bugs taken very late in the game that have caused that have had to be fixed 1, 2, 3, 4 times because every time you change the code, every single time you change it, you open the possibility of doing it. You know, and at some point, the bar becomes, okay, would we issue an MSRC bulletin for this bug? And if the answer is yes, by the way, then almost to the day we ship, if something comes in that is we think the MSRC would issue a bulletin on this problem we'll take that fix. Yeah. And if we're, like hours away and something like that comes in, we'll probably ship with it, but we'll make darn sure that by the time our customers get their hands on it, the fix is available so that their exposure is as minimal as humanly possible. I don't think that's ever actually happened where we've had something come in that close to shipping. So we've never actually had to do this, but, we're going to do the right thing. We're going to do the right thing by our customers, which is to make as sure as we can that, they're safe. That's job one. That's actually why I get so passionate and so nutty about this stuff is that, it's so important to get this stuff right. And the good news is you can get to the 90% case with only a couple of things. And, as I said, unsafe C runtime library, validate your inputs, use authentication, use ACLs when appropriate. And you're 90% of the way there. It turns out which actually frustrates me when I start seeing, really silly mistakes, which people make and people do make them inside and outside Microsoft. You know, you were talking about the TIFF vulnerability.
Yeah.
I was really surprised. I had not realized that they had reverse engineered and they found a variant of the TIFF vulnerability to that they were reusing the TIFF vulnerability again.
Yeah, this is in the iPhone.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to talk to me, Larry. I know you're a really busy guy, and maybe we'll have you on the show again sometime.
Yeah, no problem. This is enjoyable.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we will see you again next week.